This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dan Carton is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he is with us today to bring us up to date on the stories that he has put out there in print and online. And Dan, thanks for joining us, first off.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with a story that actually came out in the month of March, I guess around the middle of March. This is before the stay-at-home order, and a lot more information was really revealed here. But the story that you had talks about a conversation with Dr. Christina Box, the state health commissioner, about maybe how many people at the time that had the story out there may have contracted the coronavirus.
Yeah, this was an interview Dr. Box did in, like you said, in the middle of March, right when the governor of Ohio, who's a Republican like Governor Holcomb, was starting to take more aggressive steps in terms of closing down restaurants. The Ohio health commissioner was asked at a press conference there how many people she thought had the virus in Ohio and might not have been showing symptoms. So reporters in Indiana asked Dr. Box the same question, and she said she thought probably 1%, or she agreed that with the Ohio health commissioner that up to 1% of Hoosiers might be walking around with this without even realizing it back in mid-March, which equates to about 67,000 people. Now, just because you're infected with this doesn't mean you're going to develop symptoms, or doesn't mean you're going to develop severe symptoms that require you to be in a hospital, but this is what led into the decision to do the stay-at-home order, is that there are people, a lot of people probably, walking around with the virus in their system, and the best way to prevent that from being spread from person to person is to keep most people home most of the time so they're not given a chance to spread the virus to other people.
Mm-hmm. I know that you mentioned in your article in the conversation that Dr. Box had made, talking about having strike teams set up around the state. Tell us what those are all about, and if any word as to how successful they seem to be in letting us know more about the virus.
Yeah, this is a big concern for her, where there's a lot of people living together in one place who aren't particularly mobile. So they have these strike teams to go into county jails or state prisons or long-term nursing home facilities where, you know, the people have no choice but to gather in one room to eat or for recreation. There's a real potential for the virus to be spread among that population if it gets in there. So these strike teams the state has created have been going into these places when there is a suspected case, and getting testing done as quickly as possible, isolating anybody who they think might have the case or might have been around the person who might have had the case, and really trying to prevent these kinds of, you know, massive nursing home things that we've seen in Washington and Illinois, and now the state prison issue that they have in at Stateville Prison in Illinois, where it's just going through the place like wildfire because, you know, that's how these things work. You get a large population in a confined space, it's going to spread around.
From best as you can tell right now, do we seem to have fewer problems maybe in Indiana than in other states with the nursing home population?
Yeah, as far as is publicly known at this point, you haven't seen the same kind of group spread in terms of, you know, this particularly vulnerable population. So what they're doing now seems to be working. You know, maybe they're missing something, maybe things will come out later, but as of right now, what's publicly known is things are going, you know, about as well as could be expected.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories that you had in printed online, too, I know Dan talked about the governor's come on virtually every day with some kind of briefing, and in fact, we have another briefing coming up here a little later today, the usual one for during the week anyway. But I know he had a conversation earlier that you wrote about, too, was talking about how, we should show our appreciation for all of the folks in the restaurant business that, number one, still have jobs, and number two, are still out there looking for ways to be able to make money, and by their tips in particular.
Yeah, this was something interesting Governor Holcomb said the other day. The Times had reported on these patrons of a restaurant in LaPorte, Third Base Bar and Grill, where they've been, you can't eat in the dining room. right now, those have been shut down to, you know, prevent large groups of people from congregating together. But the people, the regular customers of that restaurant have been going in and over-tipping the people who used to serve them at their tables, who are now doing, you know, counter service or drive, well, they don't have a drive-thru, but that kind of service at other places. There was also a report of somebody who went in there and bought a $1,000 gift card and said, I'm not going to spend this until this coronavirus thing is over. So it's basically a cash advance for the restaurant to help them stay in business. Mm-hmm. And one of the, Governor Holcomb obviously saw the story in the Times and talked about what a great example it sets for other people. Now, obviously, there's a lot of people who are losing their jobs right now and can't possibly afford to do this, but the governor was saying, you know, if you're in a position to support a local restaurant by over-tipping the staff who aren't getting their usual income or buying a large gift card to keep them in business, he thought that would be a good, great thing for people who could afford it to do.
That's great. That's great. One other story, too, I know that you had in the Times here in print and online, following through on how we're keeping an eye on the revenues, which are plunging as far as Indiana is concerned because of the job situation due to the coronavirus epidemic and the pandemic, I should say, was the story that you had in about the impact it's all going to have on funding for education. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, right now they are not expecting to have to cut education. At least, well, they're saying for the entire biennium, so through June 2021, that's a big promise because a lot of the revenue that the state takes in is going to, you know, we're going to see probably next week how it hit in at least the beginning of March because some of the revenue reporting is delayed. But especially in May, you'll see how bad things were in April when it looks like everything's going to be shut down again for the whole month. And, you know, most of Indiana's revenue comes from two sources, sales tax on things you buy and people aren't out shopping, and income tax from people who have jobs and people are losing their jobs. So if you, you know, reduce the sales tax, reduce the income tax, you close all the casinos, which is the third largest revenue source for the state,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be a big hole in the state's revenue picture. Fortunately, according to the governor, Indiana has a $2.4 billion budget reserve that it can tap into to sort of cover those losses until things eventually get back to normal. But in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of tapping of that reserve in the short term.
It sounds that way, too. With what they refer to as the rainy day fund, well, it's not only raining. This is like a flood deluge right now, obviously, that we're going through in many, many ways, and that's just one of them, I guess, too. So.
Oh, absolutely. Well, even just on the unemployment and its effects on the income tax. I mean,
yeah.
The last 2 weeks have seen the greatest spike in unemployment in the state's history, so it's not good.
I know the Times continues to have stories as they come in from folks in Northwest Indiana who are doing their part to help out in the coronavirus pandemic and providing supplies for the healthcare workers and the first responders out there, masks or whatever it may happen to be. And one of the stories that you had in there, which was, I guess, on a wider basis for this, from the state prison in particular, I guess, talks about how the inmates are busy doing their part, too. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of people don't realize that the state prisons have a sort of an industrial component to it that serves as a job training and for the inmates and a cost reducing program for the state. So there's a sewing program at the state prison near Kokomo where they sew the uniforms that the prisons wear.
Mm-hmm.
And the state commissioner of the state Department of Correction, you know, reached out to these people and said, "Hey, can you guys make this personal protective equipment that is in such high demand right now?" They got some samples of the gowns and the masks and the face shields, and they figured out a way to put it together using some existing resources and ordering some new supplies. And so now these prison inmates who'd normally be making prison uniforms are now making this personal protective equipment that's going to go to law enforcement officers to keep the more traditionally manufactured medical-grade stuff for people working in hospitals with coronavirus patients.
it sounds like these are well suited for them, and certainly because they're working already on fabrics and things like that for these uniforms they're making, that it's not hard to have to make a quick switch over in the procedure to be able to come up with the masks.
Correct, and they're not alone. If you read the Times today, we've probably got three or four stories about different groups in the state, in the region, who are making masks for hospitals. And Dr. Box, the state health commissioner, said yesterday that they'll take whatever they can get, even if they don't use them directly as a mask. They'll use them over one of those N95 masks, so mm-hmm. the more protective masks can be used for a longer period of time, since it's not getting dirty or contaminated. So, it does seem like everybody's trying to pitch in and do their part.
Well, that seems to be that way, and that's what we're looking for, obviously, is more good news and positive ways that we're trying to fight this whole mess off and do it and safely and with as few problems as possible. So thank you for the stories that you and your colleagues have kicked out from the Times in print and online about all this, and we'll be back with you again real soon. Dan, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Dan Carton's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
With the latest on the economic impact COVID-19 is having on Indiana tourism, here's Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick.
Well, the coronavirus pandemic is impacting virtually every segment of the Indiana economy, some more than others. Take the convention and tourism business. It is a huge segment of the Indiana economy. 83,000 people depend on the sector for a paycheck in central Indiana alone. This week, I caught up with Visit Indy Senior Vice President Chris Gall outside the empty and closed Indiana Convention Center on a deserted Capitol Avenue for perspective on the impact. And he tells me, despite this crisis, there may be some positive news on the horizon.
In any given year, we'd welcome more than 30 million visitors to the capital city. Any given year, we have 83,000 men and women who depend on tourism for a paycheck. Globally, this COVID-19 crisis is impacting tourism first and foremost by conventions coming to a screeching halt, mass gatherings subsiding and being paused, hotels closing, restaurants closing, museums closing. And so tourism is really at the epicenter of this crisis, and we're feeling that. You're seeing that with hospitality workers no longer earning paychecks. You're seeing that with hotels starting to close. This is a time where we would be getting ready to enjoy the fruits of a Sweet 16 Elite 8 game. This is a time when our convention center would be packed with and teeming with activity. Our hotels would normally be in the 80% occupancy. We're in the 3-4% occupancy. And so it's real and clear that COVID-19 has a tangible impact on tourism here in Indianapolis.
So Chris, really, you began tracking this in early March. Talk about that process and what it was.
We started first hearing from meeting planners in early March, really March 1st, with concern. This was starting to grow nationwide, certainly globally. How is Indianapolis faring? What is the state doing? What preventative measures? Should we be looking to postpone and or cancel our convention? That uptick has been so sizable over the last couple of weeks, where we moved from reassuring our customers that we were safe and sound to not being able to welcome them. And we understand that. We understand that first and foremost, we need to keep the 83,000 men and women in our hospitality industry safe and healthy. We need to keep our visitors healthy. With the Indiana Convention Center closing its doors and having mandates to keep people safe and healthy, by virtue of that, meetings aren't occurring. They're happening virtually, but they're not occurring. And so since March 1st, we've seen this crescendoing concern, where now Visit Indy is working with a sense of urgency to take groups and meetings and events that were slated for March, April, May, and move them further in the year. Perfect example of that is our Fire Department Instructors Conference, FDIC International. Major international delegation comes every year. They've come here for more than 30 years. We're working very actively. Where can we place them further in the year? Where can we find room inside the convention center, room within our hotels, and far enough in the year that they can safely convene here?
What is that like? That has to be an incredible challenge to try to fit the pieces, moving pieces here and there to accommodate these events.
When your hotels are normally 70%+ occupancy, when your convention center is normally 65% occupancy, it's like playing Tetris. Where can you find room for a group like FDIC to be scooted further in the year, to not step on any toes of other existing business, while also finding physical space. That's a logistical feat in and of itself. Now you take the other conventions and meetings that maybe aren't as big, but still utilize portions of the convention center and hotels downtown and otherwise, and you try to scoot them further into the year, while other major cities are looking to do the same. So it's very competitive. This booking, this rebooking and postponement business from a convention standpoint is become logistically our concentration and our focus singularly. How do we keep Indianapolis healthy when this crisis ends? How do we keep Indianapolis healthy from a tourism standpoint by scooting business later in the year and salvaging as many conventions as possible that we were supposed to be hosting as a capital city?
Chris, having said that, challenging times now, are you seeing any indication of light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, in terms of conventions and events beginning to maybe look to get back into the market?
Sure. So this crescendoing buzz of postponement and cancellation, there is a bit of light and a bit of research that shows there's light moving into June and July. There's a nationwide study done on the appetite of convention meeting planners. When did they foresee looking to postpone and move and start meeting again? And it looks like June and July. Now, there's a lot of caveats, you know, what states are doing, what the government will say is what we're able to do and how we're able to convene. But that research came in this week that meeting planners across the nation are really looking June and July. So with that, and that marries well with what we're hearing from the convention and meeting decision makers we're contacting proactively, saying, hey, you're supposed to be meeting in May, supposed to be meeting in March, April, May, June, July. How can we postpone you? Where can we move you? When can we move you? And that matches well with the data we're seeing as we pick up the phone and work with a sense of urgency to move these conventions in the spring into the summer, into the fall, and dare we say into the winter.
I got to imagine another frustrating piece of this is the 2020, your projections, I think, were for a pretty good year this year, right?
Really, 2020, as the city set to start celebrating the bicentennial, a lot of progress, a lot of momentum coming into January and February. Our February hotel numbers were very strong. As you turn the page to March, you see this immediate decline. You know, the Big Ten men's and women's basketball, while playing on the court, ceasing because of restrictions, rightfully so. So, you know, the second quarter of 2020 will be painful from a tourism perspective. It will be painful for our community as a whole. The question is, can we salvage into the third and fourth quarter?
That was Inside Indiana business host Gary Dick talking to Visit Indiana Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications, Chris Gall.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time to check on the impact on business and industry from the COVID-19 pandemic. And for that, we turn to Northwest Indiana Times business reporter, Joe Sapete. And Joe, as always, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's get up to date here with the steel mills. We started out first with the story that you had about the fact that U.S. Steel had a worker who had tested positive for coronavirus, and now we have ArcelorMittal is listed on there. Where do we stand right now?
Yes, unfortunately, it appears that the coronavirus has spread to most of our major industrial facilities. There, of course, first was the two cases at Lear Corp in Hammond, and that resulted in that being shut down to be sanitized. It's remained down indefinitely for the foreseeable future. We've had two people test positive at a Chicago assembly plant with two more presumptive cases where they were diagnosed by a doctor but haven't actually taken the test yet to get it confirmed. And then we've had at least three cases in the mills thus far. Gary Works, there was a case, a worker had tested positive there, had been off work for a couple weeks, and that now they're saying ArcelorMittal has had at least two cases. At there was a contractor at Burns Harbor on the Walking Furnace project, and then the worker had tested positive in the maintenance department at Indiana Harbor West in East Chicago, and it's been kind of fast spreading. These most are some of these facilities. The Ford plant is down, Lear is down, but the steel mills have been deemed essential businesses, and the steelmakers are saying, you know, they're essential and they are continuing to operate. Obviously, a lot of workers have expressed some concerns about, you know, when the rest of the world is at home at these stay-in-place orders, that they're going to work. But a lot of manufacturers, and not just the mills, are continuing to operate and have been exempted from a lot of the you know, stay-at-home orders.
Mm-hmm. Is it a case where they're only that they can do is basically just do sanitizing and cleaning up places and hope for the best?
Yes, a lot of the companies are saying that they're doing, you know, they're doing regular sanitizing. They're communicating with their employees. They're trying to get them to do best practices, like social distancing, and to that effect, they've canceled like meetings, they've canceled training, they've canceled sales events with vendors. They're canceling business travel. They're more tightly restricting who can come into the, you know, mills. They're not allowing as many visitors and outside contractors and things of that nature in an effort to stem this. We've heard from a lot of workers from all different sectors in the economy locally that they have, you know, a lot of concerns with how safety precautions that are being taken at work. They've said they've seen things like janitors just going around and spraying Lysol into the air, which mm-hmm. wouldn't really accomplish much of anything. And a lot of people have been calling me, have been questioning, you know, why they're, you know, going to work making cabinets. And how that, why that is exempt, and how, why that is essential during this global pandemic. And so there's a lot of the industrial workers, unfortunately, do not have the luxury of working from home like some of the, you know, like white collar workers. So it's been a definite concern, especially how industrialized our economy is here in the region.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other stories that you had as well, too, in the Times, Joe, is talking about how the folks in Michigan City are trying to look to the future and trying to come up with a business recovery plan and looking for some help in putting that plan together. Bring us up to date on that.
Yes, we're seeing that in Michigan City and across the region. Lisa Beck, the state representative, also put together a District 19 task force that's asking the state for $2 million in, like, emergency funding for small businesses. They're trying to get them cash flow by giving like one-time grants of $20,000 to kind of help them, because a lot of these businesses have, you know, the bills are still due. They either owe rent or a mortgage payment, and, you know, a lot of them aren't able to meet payroll right now, but they still have utilities, they have other bills, they have, you know, debt they need to continue to service at a time when they either have no revenue coming in because they're completely shut down, or they just have a small trickle of revenue coming in, maybe from carryout to delivery orders in the case of a restaurant. Mm-hmm. A lot of the shops are now trying to sell things online through Facebook. But they're obviously not doing the same volume of business they would have before during normal operations. In Michigan City, you've had a partnership between the Economic Development Corporation of Michigan City and the Michigan City Chamber of Commerce. They have been surveying local business owners on what they need, and they've been directing them to resources like the Small Business Administration disaster loans are supposed to be made available on Friday, so where a lot of these businesses can kind of get a lifeline and get some, you know, funding through that. But they've been, you know, they are teaming up, and they're pointing out, you know, a lot of these companies have survived like a lot of disasters before. You've had 9/11, the dot-com bust, the Great Recession, financial crises. You know, we've seen, you know, major companies that have been resilient and survived major events throughout history, and, you know, this is obviously pretty significant. It's going to end up in the history books, but they are trying to, you know, get information from them and encourage them, or get information from them on what they need to survive. Yeah. And give them access to resources and encouragement. I just launched a website, actually. It's MichiganCityCOVID19.com. It has resources for businesses in Michigan City, LaPorte County, and beyond, you know, what they can do to help their employees file for unemployment benefits or get help from food pantries or the United Way to keep food on the table. It offers them access to the Small Business Development Center, the SBA for disaster loans, things that which will be administered by local banks, because the SBA has been too flooded with applications to process it all itself. But they're trying to lend kind of a helping hand to small businesses during these dark and uncertain times that are only compounded by the fact that no one really knows how long this is going to continue to go on.
That's true. They're trying to be as proactive, I guess, as they possibly can. We're talking with Northwest Indiana business reporter and writer Joseph Pete about the stories he's put out in print and online lately, and a lot of it dealing, of course, with the coronavirus, COVID-19 crisis we're under. And we have more national news coming locally now with businesses that are basically having to lay off a lot of employees and having an impact in Northwest Indiana. That's one of the stories that you had out there lately. Tell us about what the national employers like Macy's and Kohl's are having to do here to try to deal with everything.
Yes. We're seeing a mounting amount of layoffs. In March, as of the other day, there were more than 4,400 mass layoffs that have been announced. That's not all the layoffs. Not all of them are required under the WARN Act. Most of the employers are too small. At least half of the people who are employed by small businesses that wouldn't necessarily qualify for the WARN Act. But, you know, a lot of these retailers announced they're going to close for a couple weeks, Macy's and JCPenney's and so forth. And initially they said, you know, we're going to keep paying our employees, we're going to, you know, keep providing them with benefits and so forth. But I think initially the hope was, you know, this is maybe going to last a week or two, we're going to beat this thing and we're going to move on. But now when it's, the dates have been moved out to at least April 30th as far as staying at home to stop the spread of this deadly virus. The companies have already paid the workers for two weeks. Now Congress has passed the plan with emergency unemployment to help workers through the situation. And so a lot of the employees are being moved onto furlough, you know, where they, presumably in most cases will have a job when the things get back to normal, but are laid off for the time being. Macy's announced it was going to lay off 130,000 workers nationally, including at the South Lake Mall and River Oak Center in Calumet City. Kohl's also announced it was laying off about 85,000 to 90,000 employees. They have multiple locations all over the region. Hobby Lobby had initially started to, or initially had stayed open through this thing, but has finally ended up closing down and laying off its workers. Some of the even more surprising ones is Three Floyds now. It had to lay people off from its brew pub and its distillery room. They've been one of the most successful, you know, biggest success stories in the region. They seem to have kind of almost a recession-proof business going, but, you know, these are just extraordinary circumstances where, you know, you can't operate a dining room and you can't, there's just nothing for people to do. Like, you know, these restaurants that are reduced to skeleton staffs, basically, where, you know, you need some people in the kitchen to cook. You might need a server to bring the food out to curbside pickup. Apparently, so in some cases, a lot of the delivery drivers are a lot of the wait staff is being, you know, turned into delivery drivers, but there just isn't enough jobs for, you know, a restaurant that would have like 10 servers on a shift, so they just don't have anything for them to do right now. So you've had just widespread layoffs across the restaurant and, you know, retail industries. These businesses are not open, are not allowed to operate. The unemployment claims in Indiana skyrocketed by more than 6,000% last week. Nearly 3.7% of all working Hoosiers in a single week were basically forced out of work. They were either furloughed or laid off last week, and the unemployment figures have just been skyrocketing.
Now, you mentioned here also too about the restaurants having to extend their operations where they can't have any dine-in customers, and that's because the governor has extended that for another week, and of course they're trying to deal with the best they can. In some cases, I guess they can have drive-through and they can have some carry-out, but that's some at least brought out to the curb, but that's about it. And you mentioned also, too, in a separate story in Valparaiso that Jordy Jack's barbecue basically just had to close, and it's all because of the coronavirus.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is not a good time. There might have been some businesses that were kind of already faltering or struggling a little bit, and then this kind of just took everything over the edge where, you know, they're basically, you know, they can't operate in a normal fashion. They're bringing in a fraction of the revenue they might have through carryout and delivery, but you've seen, unfortunately, you've already seen some restaurants have been closing. Abuela's in Maryville by the, you know, South Lake Mall and the I-65 and US 30 interchange that ended up closing permanently. Several locations nationally too, I think the chain, and Jordy and Jack's, which had moved into the old Petey's Grill Euro place, Petey City Grill Euro's place on 30. That now closed after a little more than a year. The owners kind of said, you know, they had construction last summer and now they have, you know, now they're forced to close because of the coronavirus and the stay-at-home orders, and they just never had a really chance to get off the ground. It's sad because they were, the owners had been like working in the restaurant industry for decades and had always dreamed of owning a place, and they finally get it through, and then they just face some of the most adverse circumstances trying to get the restaurants off the ground. And the one issue, this is so devastating for restaurants, is that many of them operate at razor-thin margins. The grocery business, the restaurant businesses, any businesses that involve, you know, food and so forth, they're usually, the profit margins are usually only like a few percent. These are not, you know, they're not just, you know, bringing in money hand over fist. These are, they're operating on very tight, you know, margins. And it's, you know, circumstances like this prove to be very difficult. I've seen some stunning and staggering statistics that I don't hope, that I sincerely hope don't pan out, but like one of the restaurant associations was saying as many as 75% of independent restaurants could end up failing as a result of this.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, there's been some federal aid that's been passed. SBA loans are becoming available at local banks on Friday. Hopefully it doesn't come to that. You know, there are other efforts to seeking relief, but unfortunately this is probably going to litter our landscape with a lot of like permanent closures, not just the temporary ones we're seeing now.
Well, Joe, let's finish up with one more story here about the impact of the COVID-19 epidemic, pandemic, and the impact on Northwest Indiana in particular. One of the latest stories you have out as well in the Times and print online starts out, during the coronavirus pandemic, region residents have been stocking up on hand sanitizer, toilet paper, bottled water, guns, and ammo. Tell us about that, what may be to some a very disturbing story.
Yes, there's been, obviously we've all seen the rush at the supermarkets. People have been just hoarding and stockpiling items, particularly, you know, all those ones you mentioned. This is also a kind of a national phenomenon where a lot of the gun stores have been seeing like record sales, like South County Guns in Cherryville reported they've seen some of their best-selling days since this thing started. Wentworth Sports in Gary, they've been had lines like 100 deep at times. Like a lot of people have been running out and trying to stockpile guns and ammunition. Apparently, it's like a lot of first time. A lot of the reports I've been hearing, it's a lot of first time gun buyers. In the case of the ammo, a lot of the ammo is being sold to people who already have guns, and some of it is probably like with the toilet paper, where people are concerned. You know, they're like long lines out the door, and you know, people are buying toilet paper because they just know it's so hard to come by right now. It's not necessarily, you know, since so many other people are snapping it up, they're concerned about shortages. But a lot of people, a lot of the gun stores are reporting that they've been incredibly busy. Blythe Sports in Griffith and Valpo, they ended up being so depleted on inventory that they had to close their Valparaiso location and consolidate in Griffith for the time being, because they were partly concerned, partly so that their employees to treat their employees well and give them time off, but then partly because they wanted to make sure they had enough inventory for people to come in to like kind of look at. And then a lot of the other owners have said there's been a 2-week delay on like many items because all the distributors are completely strapped. A lot of they're saying people are generally buying guns because of, you know, fear and economic uncertainty, particularly with the economic situation. There's concern with so many people being put out of work and not having savings that they're going to be inclined to, you know, rob or burglarize. And a lot of the people are motivated by wanting to be able to, you know, protect their homes and things of that nature. But they're just saying it's been flying off the shelves. The stores have continued to be open. They were specifically exempted by the governor's order as essential businesses, so the stay-at-home orders don't apply to them.
Joseph, thank you very much. A lot of very sad stories, and it needs to be updated constantly, it seems like, these days. And we appreciate you spending some time with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about these latest Northwest Indiana business stories, and a lot of them that have national stories that are having impact locally as well, too. And we'll be back with you in touch for updates very soon, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Hopefully the circumstances change soon. You know, we're all in this together. But thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. Joseph Pete is the business writer and reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana.
For people who are staying at home amid the coronavirus pandemic, the Northwest Indiana Red Cross is offering a virtual version of its Zero to Hero program. Kristen Marlowe Kellerman, Executive Director of the American Red Cross in Northwest Indiana, discussed the benefits of the program and the need for volunteers with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Here's the conversation.
Can you tell me about the Zero to Hero program?
I sure can. Zero to Hero is an opportunity for folks that want to get engaged in what we call our Disaster Action Team volunteer services. It's going out and responding to a family after a residential fire. It's responding to families that are displaced after an apartment fire. It's working and helping with sheltering situations when there is a community shelter that needs to be opened in response to a disaster-type situation. It might be a flood. It might be a tornado. It might be, you know, a declaration for bad weather, where there's a power outage and we need to get folks safe and warm. So it's an opportunity for folks to get trained in disaster action team response with the American Red Cross and to get that training done in a quick period of time. So they're learning about sheltering fundamentals and they're learning out how to respond to a fire. They're learning just what disaster response looks like. This is a virtual training. It's allowing folks to be able to do the training while they're in this stay-at-home order where they might find themselves with a little bit of time on their hands and they've always thought about doing some volunteering, and this is a great time to get that training out of the way. So it's a fully virtual training program that will allow folks to sign up on Saturday and come out the other side on Sunday with all of the training requirements completed to serve in a disaster response role for the American Red Cross here in Northwest Indiana.
Is there any cost to participate in this?
There is no cost whatsoever. The only thing we need is to make sure we get folks connected to the online platform. So, you know, some folks that are already volunteers with the American Red Cross are receiving emails and things right now that are linking them to those resources. Folks that have never thought of or have thought of and never signed up to be a Red Cross volunteer, the only thing that we would need right now is connection with their email account. So we can send them the links for that information and they can get signed up quickly. So those are basically the only requirements and then some time. This is the first one. This is the first time we've run this program virtually. It used to be up until a couple of weeks ago, it was an in-person weekend. We just hosted one out of our Maryville office a couple weekends ago and got everybody trained through. But in the environment that we're in with this stay-at-home order, we felt it was really important and we wanted to continue to connect to those potential volunteers and also give folks at home something to do if this is something that they've been thinking about. So this is not the only one. It just happens to be the only one I have a date and time on right now.
So how is the Zero to Hero program being applied with this COVID-19 situation? You were talking about the virtual stay-at-home classes. Anything else that you can mention?
That pertains to Zero to Hero and why that's rolling out now virtually?
Yes, that. And do these volunteers, are they deployed to respond to anything in reference to the troubles that people are having now with COVID?
Yeah. So here's the thing. We don't know what all the response needs are going to be for COVID-19. So the American Red Cross is still doing preparedness, but some response in certain areas. Basically, what the posturing of the American Red Cross is doing currently to make sure that it's not disrupted by COVID-19 is we need to make sure that our disaster action team, which is the folks that would be going through this zero to hero training, we need to make sure that our disaster action team has all of the training and resources they need to continue to respond to disasters. So this particular team would not be training up to do COVID-type responses at this point. It would be training up to make sure that as folks are having house fires and being displaced, as there are apartment fires that continue to happen, as we go through this bad weather this weekend that could potentially create some issues for us, as these disasters continue to happen, you know, disasters don't take a break and stay at home during COVID, so they are continuing to happen, and residents continue to be affected by that. So the preparedness side for us is making sure that we continue to train up volunteer leaders in our communities to step up and take action when those disasters happen. So should there be a large apartment fire, our disaster action team is trained and ready and has all the resources it needs to handle all of those families that are currently in a stay-at-home, under the stay-at-home order. We need to make sure that we can find them shelter right away. We need to make sure that they are housed somewhere. So it's indirectly affecting everybody that's dealing with this COVID. And then we also don't know what the overall needs for COVID response are going to be. So as community needs change, the Red Cross's ability or need to respond will respond appropriately for that. So I know that's kind of an odd way of answering that question. They're not being trained just specifically for this issue. They're being trained to handle disasters through any issue. This just happens to be a real unique time.
Understood. Do you think that the virtual training, does it prepare the volunteers just as well as the in-person training? Are they getting the same kind of preparation?
They're seeing the exact same material. So it's the same thing as our college students coming home and doing their virtual studies. The exact same material is being presented. What's being lost is that classroom-style setting where you're having some open engagement conversation, you're doing the smaller study groups at a table. You know, it's still on a Zoom platform, so there's opportunities to jump in. There's opportunities to have some face-to-face and some input. But it's not the same delivery, but it's the exact same material. So, yes, they're absolutely being prepared to the same level as if it were the in-person course. It's just a different way of delivering and absorbing that material. It is what we call a virtual instructor-led program. So it's not just sitting at a computer and listening to the computer web class talk to you. You're watching a live person do that instruction. So you get that part of the delivery, but you're just not sitting in a classroom with everybody else, but the material is exactly the same.
Thanks so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
You know, the only thing I would add is, you know, in times like this, a lot of people are trying to figure out what they can do and how they can help. And we at the American Red Cross, while we are in a 24/7 operation mode, as we are continuing to prepare for what could happen with COVID and we're responding to what's currently happening, those other components of community-based disasters are happening on a regular basis as well. And to be able to have the volunteers at the community level ready to step in when our neighbors need us and when communities really need us to show up, times like this are times when we really see the community come together, and folks that have thought about volunteering and have thought about some type of disaster response, this is a great way to figure out if it's something for you or not. You mentioned earlier about deployment. This is also a great way to get involved, get engaged, and get the training necessary should you want to do some of those larger disasters, you know, the coast for the hurricanes and the wildfires, you know, the major flooding events, those types of things.
That was Sharon Jackson speaking with Kristen Marlowe Kellerman, Executive Director of the American Red Cross in Northwest Indiana.
And that's it for our Best of Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Thanks for listening.